but it's always time to go exploring. Welcome to Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jake McDonald. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I've spent the bulk of the summer at Strathcona Park Lodge, an outdoor education center, which sits along the shore of Upper Campbell Lake, just outside the Strathcona Provincial Park boundary. You guys will hear a little bit more about the history of the place and the man that runs it with his wife, Christine. They've been doing that since 1993. Jamie instructs lots of water activities as well, and he's a sea kayak guide full examiner. The lodge is a very unique place full of great people. In fact, today is one of my good friend Karen Havlas's birthday. So if anyone from the lodge is listening, please give her a hug or a high five or something. And I hope you have a great day, Karen. Now let's get into it.
Okay.
Hello, this is Jamie Boulding from Strathcona Park Lodge and Outdoor Education Center, or maybe you've heard of COLT, it's Canadian Outdoor Leadership Training. Things that also happen here, and many people around BC have been involved in this place. It's a business that's been 60 plus years. It's been active. So, like I say, I grew up here. My parents actually were a couple UBC students from the early 50s, and they got a passion for camping, and my mother had a practical side as well, so business and college and things. And so they decided to start a business in the late 50s that was part resort, part summer camp. Mm-hmm. And in the 60s, it was a little more resort because our... We could turn that video off, couldn't we?
We're sat here in Jamie's living room. Yeah. that's the main radio going off. Because you're a man always on radio, I've heard.
I think I'll go turn it off.
Sounds good.
Back to Jamie Boulding here. I was jumping off a little bit of how I ended up here, being in an outdoor education world, mm-hmm. at Strathcona Park Lodge. So as I talked about, my parents, Jim and Myra Boulding, started this business in the late 50s, and they were a couple of UBC students from the early 50s, mm-hmm. and they had a passion. They took actually some rec courses from some influential people, and my father thought a summer camp was something he had a passion for. So that was something I always dreamed about. It was the school teachers, both my parents were, but we actually had... You know, they were doing education, they wanted to do outdoor ed at the center, but had to sell tourism stuff to actually fill up the rooms.
Right.
And they stayed on that, but went full tilt into outdoor education in the 70s. So that comes along with me. I sort of grew up this place as a young person, you know, early days, we had lots of cool people through in the 70s when I was influential time. You know, people who went through Outward Bound and started Outward Bound in Canada came right. and worked for us too, and all sorts of people. And I ended up heading off to UBC in the early 80s. And I was hanging around there for about 6 or 7 years, actually. Mostly enjoying playing basketball and rowing for the team and doing all sorts of
sports. For the varsity team, right?
Yeah, I did a couple of varsity sports just because you're tall, you get to do things. But it was an interesting time, and I might still have gallivanted along more outdoorsy stuff too. I did actually canoe and kayak and whitewater race and all mm-hmm. these sort of things at that time as well.
Would you say that sea kayaking became a main avenue for you later in life? Because I was reading your...
Jumping into sea kayaking, absolutely. Well, in those times, they started making sea kayaks. Mm-hmm. And like one of the boat manufacturers... Necky kayaks. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a whitewater guy. I was on the team with, and my sister was a race racer, and I knew Mike as a teenager and things. And you know, they built their first boats in the early 80s and things. So it was just an infancy. You know, we did our outdoor tripping mm-hmm. in canoes before that because right, really wasn't, like, there wasn't good kayaks
in the open water as well.
Yeah, right? You just use canoes and you'd have a powerboat to support if you needed something. And but it was a different time. So mm-hmm. sea kayaking really was. It was lucky enough to learn to kayak. When we, you know, had those things and got right into sea kayaking at that time. But I came back, actually, to work at Strathcona in 86. My father got sick and he died of cancer. So I was back here and was chief instructor for a while. And slowly my wife moved back as well. And we took over management. And believe it or not, in 93, I think we're full management of the place. And so the last 30 years, we've been managing Strathcona mm-hmm. Park Lodge.
Right.
So my wife Christine and I have done that and have three kids here and continue to, have a passion for it.
Mm-hmm.
What I like to tell people is it's been an awful lot of work and it's never been many, many struggles, but it has been interesting and never boring.
Never boring.
And you are satisfied with maybe the difference you make. And if you can find jobs that, you can sort of say whose life you want to trade with, you're making some difference.
Mm-hmm.
You're always on call and there's always toilets overflowing and staffing issues and vehicles breaking down and groups that come and don't come or get mixed up in the translation. But overall, I think that we've had very great clients, great employees that are very passionate about it. And, it's outdoor education has developed so much.
Mm-hmm.
And you're even more satisfied as we learn, like everything in society, we learn what works and what doesn't work. And it's an ongoing growth of the background, knowledge of what's working, taking people in the outdoors, and how that becomes even more powerful in the modern generation.
Yeah.
It's just so easy to become addicted to your screens and
completely
and not get out there and actually all those things that, the intangibles, when you actually have to go out and work with a group of people and climb a mountain or figure out how to overcome the bad weather and keep everyone warm and dry and all these things and look after who those people are having a bad day. So much type 2 fun, which maybe if you're into the outdoors.
Do you want to explain type 2 fun to listeners?
I would say type 2 fun is you just have to explain people that you laugh and joke and grumble and are tired and everything else, but it takes things to a different level that are just so much more imprinted in your memories.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of things we do that are just sort of instantaneous fun, they don't have really any sticking power.
Mm-hmm.
And the reward of actually getting out there and doing something that's challenging and then actually overcoming and having success is just so much more rewarding and it's richer, right? It's just you realize, oh, I can have fun. I can just laugh at it and break out and dance a song on a rainy day. And then it just
gets you through.
Ups the energy level a bit, and we're not sort of just cruising through it. We're having to be fully present and committed.
Indeed.
And then the experience is just richer. And that's, it's easy to do. As you get better and better skills, you get to do a lot of stuff in really ridiculous weather. And it's just fine. It seems to be special. I'm always here keeping the ship going here.
Mm-hmm.
But when I do contract work for the last 30 years, it's usually like in February in Alaska or something.
Or the
Charlottes and it's sleeting.
Yeah.
And we go for a week with a staff training for some organization that wants training.
Right.
And we have a ton of fun. Because I've done so long, the skills are there. No one has to be miserable. You just got to stay busy and active. You can't stop moving all day long or you get cold.
Mm-hmm.
And you just keep that line.
That's the best motivation.
It's the best motivation. Yeah. And then the richness of the reward of the experience that's so intense is classic type 2 fun. So things that I've done that I enjoy doing contract work in off season, because even though the weather is horrendous, it can be actually very rich and rewarding.
Do you find that this is a good place for new instructors or people who are newer to the industry to grow and develop skills?
I really think so. That's a good way of putting it. I think you never can. You need to find new staff all the time that bring some energy and passion, but you actually have to manage them. And I think we are lucky enough to actually have a very good safety record to realize that you just have to make sure you give the right amount of support and set your instructors up for success.
Yeah,
you still can't hold their hand. So if you send someone out with a group of kids, you need to give them all the tools and encourage them that these are kind of factors. It looks like the weather report's going to say this week, and we'll be there for you. And and they'll be surprised when you actually show up in the van to pick them up when they weren't expecting you, because they say, "Well, I knew you'd be here."
Yeah,
sort of thing. So it's, we've been around a long, long time doing outdoor ed for 50 years here.
Yeah,
and you know your local area very well. So if the wind's blowing unusually, that's not going to be good for this group in that spot. They're not going to be able to paddle against this headwind.
Yeah,
you better go pick them up because they're not going to be able to get home.
Yeah,
and that support, I think, if you look at the risk analysis, I think having closer to this your center type supported things by the management, it does actually on some of the big risk analysis that Albert Mound and Knowles and people have done over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So the exotic trips in the remote spots without any backup or safety net or people that know the local terrain, it does up the risk level, which can be valuable in itself, right? I think there is, we're not against really getting out in real wilderness, but it's interesting we start talking about probably not appropriate for inexperienced campers that are you know, 12 years old
yeah.
or 14 years old. You know, yeah. you need to actually realize it does up the risk, and you need to actually provide the right level of experience. And you'd be surprised that it doesn't matter to the kids. I've friended many of our passionate outdoor people who get into it because they love to explore, and I do too. I like to go to somewhere new. My kids will tell you growing up that dad always is it's an exploration every time dad goes anywhere, because you do the same trip over and over again to be safety, because you don't know the clientele, yeah. what they can handle.
Yeah.
Okay, that hike might be a little hard. We'll just do the same one we always mm-hmm. do, because this will be just right. And the students are fine, even if they thought the climbing bluff that they did is the giantest thing they ever saw, because it's the only one they've ever saw. Mm-hmm. So if they only climbed 30, 25, 30 feet in the air, that was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So you can't use your lens to think how hard a challenge it is.
Well, you don't want to be at your limit.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you don't want to be at your limit and things. And, you know, you don't want to scare people off. And mm-hmm. I think so many people, my funny analogy is I've watched whitewater paddler. It's jadis too. But I've rarely seen a whitewater paddler who's into it manage to get in a relationship and commits their partner to get into whitewater paddling without failure. And the failure usually comes in your ability to judge what's appropriate for their fill out.
Yeah.
They're trying hard to be a good mate and hang yeah. out with you and be supportive, but you're going to scare them off in the end because you're clueless.
That's
how terrified they really are.
That's
and they're being a good sport. So many a friend of mine who's a whitewater paddler has tried to get their, you know, mm-hmm. better pick one. If you want a whitewater paddler as a partner, you better pick one that's already a paddler, because if you try to make one and you teach them, it's not going to go well.
That's a common trend with my friends say.
Yes.
It's not. I mean, if you are trying to get your partner into it, maybe get a friend to teach them.
Yeah.
Don't be their instructor, no.
Yes, don't be their instructor. All these little things. But, I mean, it's the same thing in the outdoors. It happens in the mountains and everything
yeah.
else. You know, you can't mold them for yourself, and you mm-hmm. can't make decisions what you think is reasonable, because your judgment is going to be a miss on that one, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we all are blind to this. But what we think is, oh, this looks totally safe. So we've actually had all of that, you know, and we keep track of all the near misses. We say, well, that was, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's
yeah,
too much hazard
of
rock
few.
Fall. We're not going to
yeah.
climb that mountain anymore because mm-hmm. rocks fall down. And we didn't think it was a rock fall issue. But
mm-hmm.
hey, if you do 100 trips, you always said, okay, occasionally they do fall down.
Yeah.
We don't, maybe we can't go there anymore because no one wants their kids going in a rock fall area
mm-hmm.
and stuff. So things that we used to do when we paddled harder rivers and climb harder peaks, but the students have just as good of experience on a nice, safe
mm-hmm.
Choice
indeed.
For their outdoor education. So,
yeah.
And it also doesn't stress out and burn out your employees from being
mm-hmm.
too much. There's lots of good stories like that about even the original days of Adventure Travel Company. They were the first people in it were total explorer cowboys. They started companies going really well, but I can still remember like their employees used to complain because the boss used to send them on trips they didn't know where they were going.
Mm-hmm.
It was a total long show, and they hated them because there was so much pressure on them.
Right.
The boss could do it because that was just their personality. They liked it to be a little bit wild. But I think for delivering a great program, you need to have people scout things out and have the right safety net.
True enough.
So
yeah.
That's one of the keys to success for sure.
I feel that you here are usually the ultimate safety net. Do you feel that way?
I'm not the only one, though.
No.
I think, you know, and I love that. I encourage people. I think you are. So having bring a lot of experience helps, and we have lots of very experienced people on staff, so
mm-hmm.
at the director level. But back to that same sort of safety net, it still comes down to the person who's the adult in charge, say, in
mm-hmm.
the youth group. To, you know, one of my mantras going on is to keep on encouraging people. No, we're never going to question if you turned around or
mm-hmm.
wanted to bring this kid home, or this is not a good situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's up to you to make the plan, because you're
mm-hmm.
not there. It's not like a classroom where you can have the video camera watching, or the principal's going to walk by and look in the window. You're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to encourage people. The real first safety net is just using good judgment and
mm-hmm.
just keeping an eye on things. And I think that's important for sure.
Yeah. Have you instructed yourself?
Oh, yeah. No.
Yeah.
I talking different eras. I remember back in the, whatever that was, late 70s, but I would go out as a summer camp instructor. It's like 17... You know, and I would have students of my age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was
and that wasn't uncommon actually in summer camps in those days. I know there's lots of like even whitewater trips in Ontario. They'd
mm-hmm.
send them off for 3 weeks with teenage guides.
Mm-hmm.
The kids were a couple years younger and stuff. So
yeah.
I was already teaching whitewater as a 16 to 17 year old, helping
yeah.
out and having my own group.
It's an interesting
dynamic. Adults,
yeah.
No adults around.
Yeah.
Before I was even off at UBC,
it's,
and
yeah.
you actually, you know, you had a lot of confidence because that was just the way it was done.
Almost more generative sometimes when
yeah.
you can connect with them in that way.
The world was a simpler place, though. I lived on my own in high school, too.
Yeah.
River, so it was, you know, My parents just dropped me off and gave me an apartment. I said, well,
there you go. School.
There you go. Yeah. We're busy.
Don't be late. Yeah.
A couple school teachers figured you. They believed in, yeah, the self-sufficiency that we talk about a lot. That in people, the outdoors brings that to yourself.
Yeah.
You have to trust people to be self-sufficient,
mm-hmm.
see the challenge, and proceed.
Have you had experience seeing safety standards change firsthand in this industry?
Because, oh, yeah. It's always changing.
Yeah.
I mean, and everything in the world changes and things. You know, mm-hmm. engineering changes, safety standards for them. But the outdoor business say, well, that didn't really work just because we always did that ropes course element that way. You know, it seems to be occasionally is a bad experience. Or you hear about, it just takes one issue and, okay, that design doesn't work for zip lines. You know, you can't be doing somewhere. I hope it wasn't you that made the mistake or something, but, you know, they actually do change things because that's not a safe boat for a situation. You know, you have you know, it's not, you thought that boat flowed well enough to do rescues in rough water, but no, it doesn't really float well enough. You know, you have to, so you keep on seeing equipment improve, communication improve, and things we used to do, you know, be it the route we used to take or, you know, the challenge we'd set up. It's such an important thing. And even standards also change, even you realize on the soft skill side that you can do more damage than gain for your group benefits.
That's one of the challenge by choice stuff.
And how you actually, that takes a lot of soft skills for someone proceeding in outdoor education because, you know, just if 9 kids have a positive experience, but one will never go outside again. It will hates all athletes because the jockey kids made fun of them or something, you know. That's more damage. Your program has been not a success. You haven't had a positive thing. And that's, I think, when people really do enough debriefing and setting things up and making sure setting really boundaries that we change the way a lot of education is, trying to make it a positive experience for every last person. Everyone learns, of course, and I think education come a lot way. And we do trust a lot of our teachers that are like the head teachers that bring, a school group here to really try to find a way to make the right choices. And it's, I think, picking the right activities and offering the right activities. They're going to be, hey, do you want to do a program that's mostly art camp where they spend lots of time making sketches or sculptures?
Yeah.
That's a different way the outdoors. But, you know, you have to actually encourage all sorts of breakthroughs and just special positive moments and get the right fit. Not everyone's going to be into carrying heavy packs in the mountains.
Yeah.
Less and less, I make a joke of that, because most of the world, unfortunately, their suitcases have wheels nowadays. So
their
beats the burden skills are very weak because they've never done it before. They don't actually have ever had to carry their stuff.
Yeah. Song break.
I did like to dance back in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny, you remember the the time, just the end of disco, which was kind of fun coming out of high school and things. And then there was actually some punk stuff that was just great fun. I remember some of those early dances in my life now, like, you know, Rock the Casbah by or something like that.
Shake it to the top. Are you tired of Big Brother bookstores trying to sell you some billionaire's favorite book or Heather's top picks? Then you should check out Vancouver Books. Vancouver Books is a new online family-run bookstore. A portion of their profits go to First Nations reconciliation and environmental projects in British Columbia. They provide their customers with the most interesting books in fine arts, signed first editions, First Nations photography, fine ancient books, occult, and so much more. They also provide carbon-free delivery to anywhere in the Vancouver area. So go to www.vancouverbooks.ca to check out Vancouver Books today. That's www.vancouverbooks.ca.
Okay, let's see here. Blend equal parts science and stories. Add a few shakes of music and soundscape, and wrap it all up in a big question. How can we see this more than human world in a new light and take part in shaping a healthy Anthropocene? Catch Future Ecologies every Sunday at 8 a.m. on CITR.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Outdoor Pursuits with yours truly, Jade Quinn McDonald. Here we're jumping into more backstory on Jamie Boulding, CEO of Strathcona Park Lodge.
Jumping around a little bit here, back to UBC. Mm-hmm. What did you study?
Phys Ed and Recreation. The funny story I tell people, though, is my best marks were in computer science. And nowadays, of course, they change the software so fast, I never keep track at all. But I think it's back to your... I was already good at doing outdoor stuff and things. Mm-hmm. It's problem solving. Mm-hmm. And the hardest part, you come up with a creative idea and then you actually make it work. And mm-hmm. it's problem solving. I had to, grow up as part tradesperson and fixing the water system and, be able to know how mechanical things work and all these things. You have all these after skills. Mm-hmm. Because you grew up in a rural place like farm kids and stuff. They're just much more adaptable. Mm-hmm. Keep things going. So my life's a little bit like that, but it was kind of funny that they're... Of all the different courses you take, you're good at sports and all these things, but, funny enough, they're my best marks for computer science. And realize, of course, there's no way after all-nighters of debugging your programs and making it all work and getting the mark, I said, well, I'm not doing this for...
Do you feel like what you learned in those programs helps you today?
It's funny. I my philosophy of education, for sure, is I think it does help you. Challenge helps, right? Mm-hmm. But... you actually remember your calculus and do you actually use it? No. Mm-hmm. So I never do.
Yeah.
And do you appreciate how it was taught sometimes? You learn a little bit of education, but you learn also communication and working with teams and people. I love that kind of stuff. I remember a few times just some of your best things were when group projects went well and some of the worst things were when it was so competitive and everything else. I remember taking a commerce course and just having the wrong mix and I could not find anyone to work with. You want to work with because they were just all... so worried about their own mark. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to work in team. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be successful and make their million. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, that's disillusioning. Because you have to work with people to really have success in this world. It's a lot about communication and stuff, and you watch for success. So I think education has come a long way. I think they're improving in those areas. It was real, they have dog-eat-dog world when I was in university, for sure. They were just trying to weed people out and trying to find people. This is, you're not got an aptitude. Just had to be one bad instructor you got behind and you were done, right? Mm-hmm. You can't follow that physics line or you can't be a teacher.
Closed doors.
They close the doors all over the place and make up hurdles and stuff. Mm-hmm. And no one is doing really good counseling saying, well, I don't think that's a good judge of your mm-hmm. skill set, And why don't you try this? Or actually, the one bad course is just bad personality or mm-hmm. a prof on a bad day.
Yeah. Which is tough.
It's tough, right?
Even as an instructor, sometimes when you wake up on the wrong side of the bed, which happens to mm-hmm. all of us, mm-hmm. you just have to dig pretty deep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try not to cause any damage that day because it's not going to be your best day.
I'm just going
to
step back a little bit more today.
Yeah. Let things happen because mm-hmm. my energy levels were high. And I think that's learning in itself, right? And maybe learning, some of the struggles up and down that I had in, university courses or sports mm-hmm. or climbing a mountain. They're all... part of the rich rewards, and I don't really, I had some good times. I have no regrets going to UBC, but it is funny how I sometimes find the pretentiousness of academia is ridiculous.
It is, yeah. do you
find that there's any type of elitism in the outdoor industry, not necessarily just outdoor ed, because the lodge is outdoor ed and tourism, obviously.
Yeah. But. Is there elitism? We obviously look for people that that's not their goal, that their intrinsic reward is not how hard they climb. And interesting enough, I think that, you know, some of our absolute best, say, paddlers or climbers are not been our best educators. The correlation is not really there at all. You know, I can remember a couple of superstar climbers went on to be superstars, and they weren't quite cutting it because they were more thinking about their own climbing. You know, and sometimes I have to tell people you're training, and our guide training thing is, you know, well, I think you love this sport and you should go for it, but in your own time, if you're going to find no one's going to want to keep up, or you know, you're not going to be able to make it safe and a positive experience because people are going to walk too slowly for you, or have a different risk tolerance, or realize that your personality is also focused. It's great for, you know, accomplishing things, but you know, it's, I sometimes tell people to really, you have to have really a love of interpersonal skills to be a great instructor. Maybe a great teacher, too. You know, it's your ability to read people. And you just love those sort of skills. People are good at it. I mean, one sister was a gifted teacher, but, you know, she could walk into a room when we were even kids, she could tell who's dating who. Oh, did you look at that person? He's having an eye on that person. Oh, that's happening already. You know, there was no chance, you know, you could be sneaky because they could just read you like a book, right? And that's people that, but they want the best for everyone, right? But there's no sneakiness to it. They have very high level interpersonal skills. And I love that. I wish to attract more people, not scare them off from being educators.
Totally. Do you feel like you had any pressure in particular out of your siblings to be the one running this establishment?
I happen to be just the right stage that it sort of worked, I think. I think my oldest sibling's an academic there. Had to be a scientist. Everyone had you know, a kid already, and then my younger siblings are a lot younger. So I was the one that had the flexibility at the point to come back when my dad was sick. And I think they have always been around helping, so they actually are actively interested. There's five of us and the kids and the family. And, actively interested in the business. They've all worked here, and love the outdoors. So you know, I don't think all five of us are there. And I just, you know, you wonder that I'm the middle child, but it just happens age and stage at the time, and it sort of worked. But I was lucky enough that my partner Christine was at the right age and stage that was willing to, you know, she was had a good government job after her sport career too, and, but she was able to come back, and when we had to take over and run the place our own, I couldn't just gallivant around and instruct all the time. I actually had to be here and do management.
Yeah. And how did you guys meet, you and Christine?
National rowing team.
Ah, look at that.
Singles club. Who knew?
Wow.
Yeah. We still have all those people, yeah. Yeah, we were on the team together, and we had some social events. And funny enough, another one of my UBC buddies, so the women's team, and she was on the national team too, I think she, you know, you meet the right people and stuff. She introduced us, so there we go. I was introduced by a UBC.
Nice and organic.
Nice and organic. That's great. So you're going to have to meet this guy. Not that he's a UBC student, but he might be a good catch for you. She was a better catch. Yeah, she was a better catch for me. I got an Ivy Leaguer from a UBC. You know, that's pretty good.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what is her position here at the lodge?
She is the executive director and runs all the business things behind the scenes, but you know, we need a business side, and I think that to run a place like us that's constantly adaptable and changing, you know, like anything else, you can have a school strike, or you can have an epidemic or pandemic or anything else that happens, and all of a sudden a whole section of your business falls away. So you have to be constantly business-like and quickly adaptable, and I think that that's what we've done well with, and my parents were good at that too. You had to always come up with new ideas. You know, let's do seniors with grandkids. We came up with that idea.
Now we pause briefly for a public service announcement. What you're about to hear is a sound clip from Frank Mona, an up-and-coming edgy rock alternative band who was touring all summer. Go check them out.
Frank freaking Mona. We're back. We're here. We just played the Mac and Tofino. It was a great show, great turnout, lots of millennials. My name is Peyton, I play the drums.
My name is Ben, and I play bass.
I'm Nico, guitar.
I'm Dominic Wong, I'm the lead singer of Frank Mona.
And together, we're Frank Mona.
And you can find us anywhere you listen to music for cool alternative rock and indie music.
Check us out on Instagram, Facebook,
Twitter,
Tidal,
Snapchat.
And together we're Bumble. Frank Mona.
Check us out on Tidal.
Yes.
Peace.
Here's what fans had to say.
All right, I'm standing here outside the Mac Dirty Pub with some with some audience members from the Frank Mona show. You have some comments here. You can introduce yourself first if you like.
Hi, my name is Anna E. Califax. I would first like to say that the main singer of the show had immaculate style. I loved his shirt. We commented on his shirt.
Go Dom.
His pants. And Dom is also my brother's name. So
that makes it
minus
so much
1 point. That's not my brother. And the songs were really great. I loved listening to the lyrics.
Yep.
One song in particular was exceptionally good, and it did move my heart, and my legs did start shaking at
one
point.
And she said, do they want to break any more hearts? I don't know.
Yeah. I was listening to the song, and I was like, I wonder, well, I felt myself that I didn't want to break another heart after listening to these songs because they're so sad.
But also, you know, hopefully
I was like, maybe they don't want to break any hearts either, because love is sad, but love is also beautiful.
Yep. And what song did you come in search of?
What was it? I got it. We're talking about Everything in Aiden.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the best song I heard tonight. Reminded me of Foo Fighters. I called it out. I said, this fucking sounds like Foo Fighters. And then right after that, they played their Foo Fighters song that reminded me exactly of the song I was thinking
of. I have to say, it kind of lit up the house.
It did lit up the house. But And then they went on their little break. They came back, and then everything was lit after that. And the crowd was lit.
I know. They were worried.
It was crazy.
No, they were worried.
They were worried,
but then they came back. The stage.
Yep.
Everybody in front of the stage just started jumping around, dancing.
Yeah.
Everybody was lit. It was good.
Good. The original song was amazing.
Yep.
And it got us hyped up.
Which is fantastic.
My favorite. Yeah. My favorite of the whole set.
That's what we love the most.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you guys for your comments.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
Welcome back to Outdoor Pursuits on CITR 101.9 FM. We get back into our chat here with Jamie Boulding about Strathcona Park Lodge's role in outdoor activism and environmentalism, as well as some information about a local conservationist, Roderick Haig Brown, who was active in the 60s, 50s and 60s. So stay tuned in.
So I was curious about a little bit of the history of the land here. How many acres is the property? I know it's kind of gray.
We have about 140 acres, but most of it, like most of the park in the province, is bluff and not flat and usable.
Yep.
So I think we have like 12 acres that down are flat and usable by the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the rest of it is sort of just forested area on the back hill.
Yeah.
And it's all land that, in a little history, is my grandfather was a local logger and logged on the lake when it was flooded and things, so he bought the land at that time, so we wouldn't end up here if it wasn't a good eye for a nice piece of land by a logger who, you know, hard-working logger from his era.
And I was talking to Dave, and he mentioned Haig Brown.
He was a very influential, this is a guy called Roderick Haig Brown, who was a writer and a they used to call it a conservationist in those days. So this is before environmentalist was even a term. And, you know, they believed that good management of the stocks, you know, you'd release some fish and you'd only take the old and sickly and stuff and you'd hopefully help nature along to make sure it stayed, which is a good concept. It you know, it's a bit wanting probably in some areas because we always think we know. It's like we can always over-engineer things. But Hank Brown was a fascinating guy, and he was a real social crusader in some ways, spoke up against things, dams and parks and overfishing, and he was a local magistrate. Being like in Canberra, a small town, didn't really have any educated people, so the writer was happened to be the judge, too. And that kind of lovely story to think of that, but he was a very well-respected judge because he understood, okay, the First Nation community, you know, this is a little different. These are disadvantaged people, and he wouldn't just think, oh, we're going to send them all off to jail. He'd find creative ways to deal with it. So he was, even back in the 40s and 50s, he was well-respected. And he wrote a bunch of books that became very popular in the fishing sports crowd. And they're still worth reading. I'd recommend reading some Hank Brown books. And you know, Kemper has a real passion for it. There's a the homestead is sort of staffed by the city. And he was a friend. He was also British. And I remember as a little boy going to get to go eat at their house. And I was so nervous. The judge, the author, would have to have good table manners because they're English. You know?
Of course.
It was, I'm sure I was a failure at the table manners.
That's okay. So was he involved in how the land was kind of ceded to the lodge?
He was not Hank Brown was, but I think he was big involved in that same era because my grandfather was here working when hydro was logging on the lake, and that was actually one of the first small wins. Is this was the first lake in British Columbia where they did a careful job of logging all the perimeter and bottom trees in the lake in all the spots to make sure it was still good for recreational use.
Right. Yeah.
In BC, with so many lakes, and who cares? It basically would flood them, trees standing.
Fry Lake. Paddled, and it's just full of trees.
See, still standing. That lake was flooded.
Standing like 20 feet.
That thing was flooded. Those lakes have been standing there. And
that's crazy.
They didn't have the time to cut them down because that's progress. And so thinking early battles, but those are some of the battles, and they tried really hard not to allow them to flood right into the park, and they didn't actually win that battle. But I think they probably does bring win battles later because they realize, okay, maybe smarten them up the next time they think that we can just actually, cause, you know, once you get the right issue and get enough publicity out, everyone says, well, maybe we shouldn't have. There's some things that are supposed to be sacrosanct.
Yeah. And another movement that I heard was started by some staff here was changing... Is it down in the Elk River Delta where the actual park boundary is? I think they were going to log.
We had a small win there, which was kind of, and it was a couple staff really did all the inspiration. They were in there and they were threatening they were going to not allow it. It was just one of these silly things. The park boundary is just to do with a railway grant, and it was a valley bottom that had like 1 hectare, and this whole valley bottom is pristine. And they would have to heli log it to get the timber out of there. I always thought that's ridiculous. They're not going to go. Then the log company at least said, oh, we're going to go log it. You know, they went in there and cut one tree down so they could get their helicopter down there and measure the trees, sort of thing. And we said, well, can't you just trade for another side of the park that no one's going to see? And we did manage to convince them after much, you know. And as always, the government gets a little bit fleeced by timber companies on these things because it's good business. You know, you can always take advantage of government because, they're not as crafty. It's not of their skill set. So many of the timber trades, I think parks have given up on timber trades because they've gotten so badly taken advantage of on trades.
Right.
Historically. Lots of stories of that. But this is very, very typical sort of thing. So it was a nice win. I mean, I think the bigger win was some of the ex-Strathcona people. My father was involved in the early days that they tried to get another mine started in the park. And I think it was called the Cream Silver Protest. And a bunch of people got arrested. And this was all before Clayquot and stuff. And they won the battle because I think at the time, you know, the government really didn't realize that they could just flaunt it because people, the average citizen had no idea they were allowed to open a mine in a park. In the early days, that happened all the time. Right? You could log in parks, you could mine in parks. You know, industry came first. And, you know, but when at that particular point, that's a new thing that, okay, this is actually a, you know, a winnable battle that the public are going to be against the government who's going to approve of a mine in a park.
Right.
So, you know, and that would seem automatic nowadays, but that was a big win. And, you know, Clayquot didn't have as big a win trying to do the same thing about timber protests and getting people arrested. It had an effect, and I'm sure it did improve moral growth still standing because of it. But the cream silver one, they actually won outright. You know, they said, okay, we're not going to allow mines or parks, and they had to buy out the mineral rights. And,
well,
and it was a nice, clean win for the environmental group that spurred more, you know, passive protesting and getting people arrested.
Right. And what now would you say your relationship is with Mosaic, the forest management crew?
We tried very hard for, and we were surrounded by private timberland.
Mm-hmm.
And have had long sort of meetings, annual meetings, just what their plans are every year, and trying to give them suggestions and hope, of course, that they can find a way to trade or selectively log or be more sensitive to viewscapes and recreation and such. And it's a really tough situation because it's the biggest part of private land, forest land, and is all to do with a railway grant from the 1900s or the 1800s. So it's you know, really shouldn't be this level of private land. And but it is. And the truth is that the foresters on the ground have always been excellent. You know, they explain exactly what they're doing, why they're cutting this ways. And, you know, it's they're still learning, too. Environmental standards change. Every day you learn something new. I just heard a good one yesterday and think, oh, I didn't really think of it that way, how our long-term planting technique of high-density planting and the strongest will survive is maybe great for the best quality trees, because trees grow really tight together. They shoot up and they have clearer wood and less knots and all sorts of stuff. But of course, they're finally admitting it's really bad for forest fires. So we've been planting trees and slamming the ground, you know, every few meters. But, you know, a lot of these trees, 20, 50 years in, have died and they're standing and leaving all this dead mass in the forest, which is combustible. So a natural forest would not regen that way. So there we are. All you tree planters, I thought you were being so green in the trees. It's a business model that doesn't really fit when it comes to bring things like, obviously, climate change. Climate change does bring an extra issue, but the way we've actually planted our forests, monocultures, high density, is a bit of a disaster for forest fires.
That's great. And one thing that I like to kind of close on is how you would recommend people who are maybe interested in outdoor ed to get into this field.
Well, you know, if you're a UBC student, you should look at the Varsity Outdoor Club. I can remember talking to my uncle, long since passed, talking about what a great time they had in the 50s there climbing mountains, and the people he met and the friends that he had for life. I think sometimes getting your peer group is your greatest thing, for sure, if you can find the right peer group that wants to do things. There's lots of good training. We have all sorts of colleges in ourselves. We run a guide training programs for adults as well. They want to be guides. There's lots of good certification routes. You can start doing a bit of certification right off the bat. You know, they just start and learn. Simple as taking your first little first aid course over the weekend, you know, to say, well, start being self-sufficient, knowing a little bit more how to look at yourself, yourself and others. And it's supposed to be one of those fun things, you know. You actually keep a trip log, and that's become part of your certification nowadays for things. You know, make sure you get out there and do things.
Logging,
logging your stuff you're doing, and actually, hey, I'm enjoying it, and finding a peer group. So that's one of your keys. Finding a peer group that's what you do for recreational fun. And if you want to take it to the professional level, which may not be for everyone, like I say, some of you, if you're keen to be the greatest rock climber you can be, you know, you may not be a teaching rock climbing. You actually have to just, because you're focused on your training, and you're, you might have to take your computer science job and become a rock climber on this, that's your real passion.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been very illuminating.
I'm glad that there's still UBC Radio. We did a lot. It had great tunes back in those days.
Oh, yeah, it still does.
A bit of controversy, which we love, that the things like the UBC paper and the radio, they, you
know,
they would put forward some different ideas. I love that. In the university, people, outspoken people getting a voice, and I think I like that. So I hope that continues.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Jay.